Tonight, we are doing bitter seeds, which will be a discussion about genetically modified seeds. It is a discussion that I think will go on for the next several years. And we will, in 5 minutes, be Skyping in Micah Pellet, who I will let you know a little bit about. He was born and raised in Israel and is one of the few people ever to emigrate to the United States by hitchhiking. This comes from his own words. He had a checkered career that includes stints as an importer of hammocks and sheepskin jackets, a tutor, a prison guard, a freelance journalist, a director of the Nuclear Freeze Campaign, and the executive director of Media Alliance, which is a media watchdog group in San Francisco. And then he began producing and directing films. Our film tonight is his last in a globalization trilogy. The first movie, Store Wars, When Walmart Comes to Town, focuses on consumerism in the United States. It's a story about how the residents of a small town organized to stop the largest retail company in the world from coming in. His second film, called China Blue, is a story about one young girl in China who needed to leave her village and home to get a job and ends up working in what he describes as a jeans factory where she descends into sweatshop hell. The third is Bitter Seeds, and it focuses on the raw materials. In Pellet's words, the three films are connected as a globalization concept because in each film, quote, a Western corporation is dominating the lives of everyday people somewhere far away. Bitter Seeds has won 18 international awards. Of the film, Alice Wooders says, films like this can change the world. Michael Pollan says, a tragedy for our times, beautifully told and deeply disturbing. Peter Sellers says, better than a Batman movie, with real villains making up their own lines. And that is the person that we will be talking to in a few minutes. Now, once I say hello to Michael Pellet, I think you all should all feel very free to ask him questions. He has very definitely said he does not want a lecture. He would like to answer questions. So it would be very useful if either you have something that you would like to say or you would like to ask that you do so. Michael, welcome this evening.
Hi, good to be with you.
Oh, wonderful. The sound is terrific. I'm not sure you can see our audience, but we are in fogged out Rentschlerville, New York, and you have an audience here of about 100 people. So, Michael, we have read some of your resume and the films that you have made, particularly the trilogy. And I think I'll start out by asking you the question, did you start to make a trilogy, or how did you start, and how did it end up with three films over a dozen years?
Yeah, I wish I could say I was that brilliant that I could map out an entire project like this in advance, but I didn't. It was really serendipitous. I started by just making one film about Walmart. At the time, I found out that Walmart was opening a new mega store every two business days somewhere in America, and I was shocked by that statistic, and that inspired me to research it and make that film. And when I finished it and we created the website for it, I got interested in how the cheap goods that Walmart sells get made, and that took me to China and to the second film, China Blue, which takes place inside a blue jeans factory in China and focuses on one girl that leaves the village, like 100 million others, to go and get a job and ends up in this kind of sweatshop exploitation hell. And after that, I got interested in the raw materials, and that took me to India, to the cotton growers, and that's why there's a line in the film that says that this cotton is exported to China's garment factories, where in the previous film we saw that they make the blue jeans that Walmart sells us. So that is the connection between the three films. And I wish I could have made them faster, but it has taken me 12 years. Each one of these projects means that I immerse myself in a completely new world, new culture. In this case, I had to educate myself about the science of genetic modification as well as in everything else related to the story. And I feel a wonderful sense of completion that it's all done now.
And I gather you are in India now, and you are going through some of the villages that you visited when you made the film?
Actually, I was there last week. I did come back to the States. I'm now, you know, comfortably in my home, California.
I should be here.
They're wondering why you're not here then.
Well, California is still not New York. I would like to tell you a little bit about the trip last week because it was something really unusual. I've never done anything like this before. We had a mobile projector unit, and every evening we did a screening in another village, which ended in the afternoon. We drove a van through the streets of the village with a loudspeaker announcing that, inviting everybody to come up to, right after dark, to the square in front of the village temple, where we set up a projector and a screen and a sound system. And after we shot the film, we did it in partnership with the local farmer activist group. In fact, the man that you see in the film organizing a rally, his name is Kishore Tiwari. He was leading the discussion every night with the farmers, and we recorded that, videotaped it. And later on, we will put some clips of that online. It was definitely a different kind of an audience than in any film festival or a community center where I've shown the films.
And how was it received? How was the film received? What was their reaction?
First of all, a lot of people said that the film is a true depiction of their lives, and this is sort of like a sad, our sad story. And it is not only the story of this village, but of every other village in the area. Many people told all kinds of tales of woe about how they got bankrupted by BT Cotton. Some people said the only solution I see is suicide. We heard comments like, I'd rather go begging than ever farm again, or to grow cotton with these seeds is like trying to grow hair on a bald man's head. One woman's comment. There was a young widow of a farmer who committed suicide who spoke about the hopes that she and her husband had when they raised enough money to go and lease some land and start working it, and how her husband little by little succumbed to despair and now left her alone with the kids. And then both myself and Kishore Tiwari began to challenge them that surely, I said, you know, I've shown this film all over the world and people want to know what are the reactions of the farmers of Vidarbha, and surely they're not going to just accept this situation forever. And then people began to talk about how they want to return to conventional seeds. And people said things like, I want to farm like my grandfather did. He didn't have to buy the seeds, he saved his own seeds. Sorry, and he used his cow dung for fertilizer, and he ground the leaves of the neem tree for pesticide, and so his expenses were very minimal, and even if he had a bad year, it didn't bankrupt him. And that kind of sentiment began to be mentioned every night. The issue is, of course, that there is no quantity of conventional seed available for them right now.
And so, how do they anticipate that they will organize themselves in order to get their native seeds back.
Well, I have not heard that kind of a plan of action there, which I would have liked to hear very much. I've heard calls that we should unite and we should fight and so on, but I have not heard any specific plan. One thing that did take place a couple of months ago is that Monsanto was found in violation of some laws in India. And as a result of that, Monsanto itself is banned from selling its seeds in the state of Maharashtra, where the film takes place. But that doesn't going to stop the dominance of the BT seed in the market, because all the other seed companies are licensing the Monsanto technology. So it's only the Monsanto itself is barred from selling them. The question that you just asked is what I would have liked to hear a concrete answer to when I was there, but I have not. You certainly have heard from all over India, there is a lot of backlash against how Monsanto has taken over the seed market. But it seems to be dispersed and without any kind of a coherent plan of action.
And so let me ask you, either there or here, what does Monsanto think of you, and have they approached you in any way?
You know, Monsanto, like it's been my experience with all the major multinational corporations, that in the past 10, 20 years have been getting the best PR advice that money can buy. And part of that is to detach themselves from independent media as much as they can. And so it begins with not participating in films when they are asked to by any kind of media that they cannot control. And it continues with not commenting on it. So I have not seen any comment from Monsanto about my film. And I think they realize that the moment that they will say something, no matter how critical, it will only draw more attention to the film. Now, the reason that you were able to see a Monsanto spokesperson in the film is because I approached Monsanto India. I imagine some of you have seen the film Food Inc., which at some point has a caption that says that Monsanto refused to participate. I got tutored by the producer of that film, who told me that she had been in communication with Monsanto for months and months on end, and they were very careful never to say, clearly, no, we will not be in your film. But they were always delaying, postponing, raising new obstacles, demanding that the filmmakers interview somebody else who was pro-Monsanto, knowing that at some point every filmmaker will have a deadline and at some point they'll have to wrap up their production. And after hearing her story, I did have my assistant call Monsanto press department, and I swear they hired the nicest, you know, most affable people in the world, who sound so excited that you're making a film about their company and want their participation, but then proceed to just pump you for information about where you're coming from and what your point of view is and who's funding you and who have you interviewed already and who else are you going to include in the film and so on, but not advance at all your interest, which is to try to lock an interview with someone. But in India, they were just a bit less sophisticated, and they didn't turn me down quite a number of times. And one day I just got lucky. I called them and talked to the communication director, and he was fulminating because just that day the BBC had a 2-minute story on BT cotton seed in India connecting the seeds, God forbid, with the suicides. And I said to the communication person, well, that's what you get in a 2-minute news thing. I'm doing an hour and a half documentary, and I would like to give your company an opportunity to present its own case. And somehow it was the right day to tell them that, and he made it available for me. So that's how we got that spokesperson from Monsanto.
It's a great story. I'd like to turn it over to the audience now who has questions.
Sure.
And one question coming from the audience is, the family that you follow through the season, how are they doing both the marriage part and the seed part?
Yeah, I wish I had some positive news on that score. So I just saw them last week. And I was also bringing some donations to them from people that saw the film here and in Canada. And I sat with them, and first I asked about the family. In my mind, I thought that maybe part of the money will go towards the continued education of their second daughter, who would be becoming eligible for marriage this year. And the rest went to farming. And so I sat down and talked to them, and they said that the second daughter dropped out of high school before she finished her 12th grade. So that was out the window. And the only good news was the son. They have a young son. He's now about 11 or 12, and they said he's doing very well. Their oldest daughter, Sapna, who was getting married over the end credits in the film, she turned out that she married a bully of a man, and we actually, believe it or not, had a lot of difficulties to show the film in Talangtakli itself, because that man demanded that we don't show the film, and he threatened that if we do show it, he's going to send his wife and baby back to her parents. And that was a situation that I've never encountered before. I've had to deal with, to navigate the Indian rural culture a lot in the last few years, but that one was a new one for me too, and it started a long back and forth rounds of negotiations and discussions, because I certainly did not want to hurt the family. We ended up agreeing on some kind of a compromise, which was that two scenes in the film would not be shown. That's sort of like, there were more complications. I won't go through the whole story right now, but people said to me, Sapna, we never see her smiling anymore like she used to. Her husband doesn't allow her to talk to people. She used to be on the phone with my associate producer every now and then. My associate producer, Prachi, is an Indian journalist, lives in Pune. She would call from time to time to just stay in touch, and the husband doesn't like that. So that's the story of the girl. Now, I asked them about their financial situation, and they said, well, they still have some debts from the wedding, which is now 2 years old. But mostly, most pressing is, of course, the farming debts. And when I asked, well, what would you need money for the most? They said to pay back the bank loan so that we could go and get another lower interest loan from the bank next year. That's basically what I heard from them. And it didn't seem to me, neither one of them seemed to be in good health. They both seem to have aged quite visibly since I made the film, and it's been less than 2 years.
Well, that's certainly sobering. Particularly, it will be interesting for the audience to watch the film, since most of the audience here tonight is yet to see it. So,
that's right. I forgot you haven't seen
it. That's quite all right. It's an interesting backdrop, but maybe you also would like to tell the story about how you found this particular farmer and this particular woman to begin with.
Sure, and by the way, after you see the film, and if you have an appetite for more, I was mentioning this village tour. If you go to the Facebook page of Bitter Seeds Film, there is a day-by-day account of it. So I suggest you scroll from the bottom up from day one, and you'll see the whole story. Finding the characters was definitely an interesting adventure. As you will see from this film, For me, the character and the narrative arc is front and center rather than the issue. It's not an issue-driven film. In other words, it's not full of experts explaining things to you. There's nothing wrong with those kind of films, but my style of filmmaking is more of a storyteller, except that my stories are from real life. So when I first arrived in this area, I knew the issue, but I had to find the characters and the story. I've never been there before in my life. There are 23,000 villages in this area. Where do I go to make the film? And I started just traveling from village to village with an interpreter and asking to hear the farmers' stories. And every day I would sit in another village surrounded by a dozen or so people who would slowly begin to tell me stories of what it's like to farm and what it compared to how it used to be, and how they're not able to make a living, even though their needs are roughly about $2 a day for the entire family. But I also quickly realized that most of the farmers are not the type of person that could carry a film, because they were just too depressed, carrying the burdens of the world on their shoulders. Now, one of the things I often heard is that the neighbor who had killed himself also had a daughter at marrying age that he could not afford a dowry for. And that is considered such a cause for social shame. It's seen as the father not completing his duties towards his daughter, that tips many of them over the edge and they commit suicide. So I thought, well, I'll maybe look for a young woman to focus the film around. And I started traveling to the high schools, introducing the film to principals of the schools and asking if I could meet with a graduating class of girls. And I would find myself in a room with about 30 young women who were 2-3 months from being eligible to get married. And one of the questions that I always asked was, what are your dreams for your future? And many of them, probably a good half of these young women, would say, I really would like to continue my education, but it's up to my parents. And normally what they meant by continuing education was to learn to become a nurse or a teacher. And then one day in one of these schools, a young woman says, I want to become a journalist. And so I immediately perked up and asked her, well, why? And she said, because I want to tell the world about the crisis of the farmers. And so, of course, she was one of the people that I did go to her house and met the rest of the family. And I'm not actually going to tell you what I found there, because she's in the film, and there is a reveal about her family story at some point later in the film. But because of her interest in this topic, I thought that would be a great device for the film if we follow this young woman making her first steps writing an article, because she would be interviewing people and getting information on the topic that I'm interested in. And so once this girl, her name is Manjusha, became a central part of the film, I went to look for a farming family among her neighbors. And that's how I was introduced to Ram Krishna and his wife Sunanda. And they're very, very typical, but I also think that screen-wise, they are really formidable characters to kind of hang the story on. And you will all be judges of this in the next hour and a half.
So let me ask the audience, who has a question? Mike only has 5 more minutes with us. Philippa.
I've been trying to find what Manjusha is doing now online, and I haven't really been able to find very much about her. I've been looking online quite a bit to see what Manjusha is doing these days, and I haven't really been able to find much out about her. What is happening with her?
So at the end of the film, there, by the way, stay through the end credits, because there are updates on the characters. And on the group, it says that she is studying journalism at Nagpur University. And she just got another wonderful opportunity. When I did this village tour, I did it with an Indian NGO called Video Volunteers. Then what they do is they find young people who become community correspondents. They train them in filming and editing video and give them a camera. And these people file stories that Video Volunteers puts online, and they just offered Manjusha to become one of these people. That would be a great push for her career. Now, I'm personally a bit displeased with her because she did not take her year-end exams, and I found that she just had excuses for it, but she promised me that next time in April she will be taking them.
Good. Another question? Ginny? George?
Oh, yes. If you were a betting man, how would you bet the genetic modification discussion will evolve over the next 5 years or so?
That's the kind of question where I like to sit down, I'm just a dumb filmmaker. You know, the first thing, by the way, that your question triggered for me was that in India, you have a feeling that these people have no choice but to gamble their entire farms every year because the debt that they have to assume is often, you know, larger than all of their possessions. While in fact, these are not gambling men at all. They just want to, you know, continue doing what they and their parents have done all their lives and provide for their kids. You know, if you ask me about where things are heading, unfortunately, you know, my impression is that at the end of the day, you know, money talks. And these corporations are a lot more powerful than the rest of us. We just had in California, I don't know if you've heard about this in New York, but we've had a statewide proposition to label GMOs in food. And at the beginning of the campaign, the polls showed a very large majority of voters in support of that. It was called the right to know. So it was not going to ban any GMOs, just requiring food manufacturers to label if there's GMOs in ingredients in the food. And Monsanto donated over $5 million, the rest of the industry together, they put up a kitty of $45 million. Flooded the airwaves with commercials that scared people that if they vote yes on this, their grocery bills will go up. Of course, not telling them that this is already the law in the civilized world. Anywhere in Europe, in China, Russia, Australia, Japan, they already have these laws in the books and people survive just fine. And so even that very, very modest request to know, to get information was voted out. So personally, I do not feel hopeful. I also see huge forces like the Bill Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, joining forces to convince African countries to change their laws to allow GMOs in. Yes, 2 days ago, I had a talk at a California State University campus after the film, and students said, but how else are you going to grow food for the world's growing population, which is exactly the question that the biotech industry has been putting in full-page ads in the Wall Street Journal and in the New Yorker magazine and everywhere else. They're dominating the agenda, and they're dominating the market. And the question here is not only GMOs or not, the question is there still going to be room for family farming, or is all of our food going to be grown by industrial farming? And in this country, we've already gone through that transition. But in a country like India, you have 600 million farmers. And most of them are on the level of Ramakrishna, the man that you will introduce to in a few minutes. And these people do not have any other option. They will all become, you know, landless, poor, living in city slums and whatnot if we turn into industrial farming. So personally, I do not feel very hopeful. But I keep an open mind.
Do you have one last thought for us before we let you go? We know you have a time schedule.
Yeah, I do have to leave. Well, if you like the film, think of it as a possible holiday gift. You can reach us at anywherefilms.com. And I wish you a great screening. And it would be great to hear from you later.
Great. Thank you very much, Maya.